If a state like Texas or Florida tries to protect people's free speech rights against biased social media companies, is the state then violating the free speech rights of social media companies? And how is President Biden doing at shrinking inflation? Another issue, what's going on with Alabama's IVF laws? We'll discuss all this and more in today's episode of Independent Outlook. Hello, everybody. I'm Graham Walker, coming to you from the Independent Institute in Oakland, California. We try on this program to give you an independent take on the issues of the day. And I'm delighted that I'm joined by two of my colleagues to help in this conversation. First of all, by Phil Magnus. Dr. Phil Magnus is the senior fellow here and holder of the David J. Thoreau Chair in Political Economy. Welcome, Dr. Magnus.
Happy to be here.
And also by my colleague, Williamson Evers, a senior fellow and director of our Center on Educational Excellence here at the Independent Institute. Hello, Bill Evers.
Hello, Grant.
Great to see both of you. So let's take a few minutes and talk about this pending case at the U.S. Supreme Court. I don't know exactly where it stands. I think there have been some arguments so far, which has everything to do with the desire of some of the folks in Texas and Florida to protect people from being, what, canceled or squelched or discriminated against by social media companies. It seemed like a noble cause to me when I first heard about it, but then I wondered, what do you think?
I think it's misleading to speak about free speech rights of people in connection with a platform. The people who have the property rights, the people who own the enterprises, are the ones, just like a newspaper publisher, who have the right to decide what they're going to put there and what not. On the other hand, there's a section of the law, famously Section 230, to protect the proprietors so that they don't have to edit every single thing that's sent in, but they can still edit as much as they can or choose to do. I think the other way around, to the idea that whatever you have to say has to be carried by somebody, and sort of turning these social media platforms into telephone companies, is not really suited, and it goes against libertarian thoughts about property rights. After some other commentary and discussion, if they do end up, they have to carry everybody, there is a way that I think it will turn out that won't be catastrophic. I'm hopeful.
Right.
Phil, what do you think?
Yeah, I think Bill's assessment is pretty fair here that, trying to regulate social media companies for the content that they provide or that their users provide in some cases does step into an area where the state should not be involved. The only thing I'd add in terms of context is that social media companies have made themselves vulnerable for this exact type of regulatory attack, because they spent the last 3 or 4 years heavily engaged in collusive censorship with the federal government over COVID, right, over so-called misinformation and everything else. So I think what we're seeing is an expression of the state level of frustration with these companies over their own misbehavior in other ways that have squelched speech. Because if the federal government is actively working with the private sector to achieve censorship, that's just as unconstitutional as if they were doing it themselves. So you have kind of policymakers are backing into an area where they are using a regulatory power to counteract another abuse of a regulatory power when neither is appropriate.
So what's happening in those cases is the federal officials are leaning on the social media companies to suppress unfavored views. That doesn't seem right, because that would seem like the state government, the power of government being deployed to limit free speech. But if that's true, then who's the culprit in those cases? Is it the social media companies, right, or the federal officials?
Well, it's, I think, a collusive relationship that's emerged, because on the one hand, we do have clear evidence that the Biden White House tried to put pressure on social media companies. And they, they did kind of like the Godfather thing, offered them a deal they couldn't refuse. Either you censor for us, or we're going to haul you before Congress and haul you before the regulatory committees.
And threaten the Section 230 also.
Exactly, exactly. But then at the same time, we do know that the private sector has gotten almost infested by these woke university types that are very conducive to censorship. They view this as an appropriate role for the company. So there have been some willing participants in that internal to the social media companies. You know, we saw in the Twitter files when Elon Musk revealed basically this company he had purchased had been operating for the past several years as this collusive, willing partner of the federal government engaging in COVID censorship. So they really did set themselves up. It's like they made a bargain with the devil of inviting the federal government into their own internal policies. Yes, absolutely under pressure, but they do have some culpability for that.
Yeah, I think I agree with Phil. I do think the federal government was so wrong here that it overshadows the collusive collaborator Vichy type behavior on the part of the,
that's a good descriptor,
the companies. I do want to give one ground for hope. If the courts say there can't be moderation, that this is somehow a public space like the Pruneyard case or whatever, a public forum, some kind of utility that where the owners are just stuck with whoever speaks up. And that is that if that happens, the users will want to form their own moderation groups within it. So just as you have groups right now on Facebook of John Wayne lovers or 1930s automobile lovers or whatever, you'll have much more of that. And then the people will essentially pick the moderating situation, milieu that they want. So I think the demand will be there for editing no matter what, but I think it's better to keep it with the private property owners.
Right. Right. So in other words, what you're arguing is that even though some of the legislators in Texas and Florida may have been reasonably motivated, that they should still lose in the case because the speech rights of the private companies shouldn't be violated.
So if I got the that property rights.
That's essentially it.
By the way, that's the way the questioning, and so the lawyers for each side have appeared before the Supreme Court, and that's, it looks as if the justices are leaning in the direction of a property rights basis.
Right.
It seems highly likely. Yeah. Bill, you said to me recently that there were some interesting comparable issues in Canada. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, Canada, my old graduate student advisor, the late Seymour Martin Lipset, once wrote a book called Continental Divide about the difference between political culture in Canada and the United States. Not, you know, a novel insight on his part, but he put in lots of empirical evidence about how it's played out. So the idea is that Canada is most influenced by the French Canadians, who were more royalist than the royalty suffered from the French Revolution, and that the British people in Canada were influenced by the loyalists who fled the American Revolution because it was too libertarian for them. So it tends to have much more power in the hands of the government, the central government. There are exceptions, but so Trudeau, son Trudeau, as opposed to the father, who was pretty bad also. But anyway,
fils rather than père.
Fils, exactly.
Yeah, Trudeau fils.
Pair. Yeah. So anyway, so they have this idea they're going to have a safety commission for a social media, and it's going to be secret.
I'm feeling safer already.
Yeah.
It's going to be secret. And it's going to decide whether something can be up or people can be up or groups or whatever based on its judgment of safety, not on any effects. In other words, let's say
you're
going to be
completely transparent on this, right?
No, they're not going to be transparent.
Exactly.
But the thing is, let's say you had speech that caused a riot. I don't know. I'm trying to come up with some plausible thing. Okay. So you might want to say afterwards, we're penalizing you. Here's a fine for putting up something that caused a riot. Okay. Or red riot. But no, they're going to censor the stuff beforehand, not wait until afterwards for a consequence. So, I mean, I'm not really happy with censorship of the press before or afterwards. But the point is, it's more onerous for freedom to do it, the censorship before, rather than penalizing it.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, the Canadians are not moving in a good direction on this. The U.S. Supreme Court is likely, as you say, to come down on the side of speech and property rights in this case, and I understand that. I just wanted to add that, you know, when you look at the picture overall, this stuff, the collusion with the feds was troubling on the part of the social media companies. And one particular instance of it actually struck pretty close to home here at the Independent Institute, which our viewers may be interested in knowing. So some people may remember that last year, President Joe Biden, he was calling on Facebook to censor some accounts that had been giving the wrong message on climate change issues, what he thought that was the wrong message. And he accused Facebook of killing people in public. He said, you're killing people by platform and giving platform space to these people expressing skepticism about some of the alleged scientific conclusions around climate change. That was pretty extreme. Well, I discovered recently that President Biden was relying upon a list of offenders, which was created by a private group called the Center for Countering Digital Hate. Center for Countering Digital Hate. They put out...
That's right there. Your red flag should go
I
up.
I know.
The Orwellian nature, the way they label themselves.
Yeah, so they're against digital hate. And so it turns out that this group put out a list of YouTube channels that are guilty of fostering digital hate, which in this case meant, apparently, putting on things on their YouTube channels that didn't fully agree with dominant views about climate change. And the Independent Institute here in Oakland, California, was on the list of culprits.
It sounds like an honor roll to me.
Well, it kind of was, because it had, for example, the American Enterprise Institute, but it also had the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton.
Yes.
Wow.
Which is as mainstream can get. It was founded in the 30s for Albert Einstein. It's totally mainstream.
Not that we're talking, requesting donors to send in money right now, but actually that could be used in a mailing I'm sure if it were Heartland, they would.
To me, it's stunning that we, along with the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton,
I know, that puts
are
us
being
in
accused.
Very, very,
good company.
Very high-level company.
Yeah, so it's pretty stunning. It's pretty stunning to be accused of digital hate when all we did was put a few things on our YouTube page that expressed doubts about particulars about scientific conclusions based upon other scientific evidence.
Yeah.
How could that be hate?
Yes.
We draw on climate scientists that have their own views about it. So we should go to another topic, but that is an absolutely fascinating story, Graham, and one that you have kept from me.
Well, okay, let's talk about Joe Biden in a different mode. I was just talking about him. But speaking of President Biden, how's he doing on shrinking inflation? And can somebody please tell me what shrinkflation is all about?
Oh, boy, that's fun. So Joe Biden is certainly taking credit. He's trying to take credit for actions that brought inflation back down to tamer levels, which, yes, we have seen in the wake of the Federal Reserve's decisions over the last year to year and a half. They actually did, by raising the interest rate, they were able to tame some of the inflationary pressures that had been underway. But Biden is saying that that's not really the reason why. He's claiming the Inflation Reduction Act, which was really just a giant expenditure act. But on top of that, he is, by all indications, going to attack what he calls shrinkflation in the State of the Union address. And this is the notion that, like, if you have a bag of Doritos, You have, you know, prior to the inflationary period, you had a fuller bag of Doritos. Now they're putting more, they're putting fewer chips inside the bag and charging you the same price for it as a way to deal with basically the economic consequences of Biden's own policies for the last year and a half.
Good grief. Well, I it is annoying as a consumer to discover that there's less of it, but is that really the proper thing for the federal government to somehow penalize?
Well, I think actually, as has been pointed out, that shrinkflation helps the Biden administration because the one of the biggest complaints that the public has about the Biden administration is the high prices and the fact that they're persisting.
Right.
So Phil is, of course, right in saying that it's not getting worse particularly fast right now. But it's still very high compared to the beginning of the Biden administration.
Yep.
So the companies are faced with, you know, how are we going to deal with this? We have to cover our costs, and our costs are going up, and we don't want to face consumer resistance to higher prices. So, and we don't want consumers to give up our product. So we'll put, the late Professor Murray Rothbard used to say, well, they'll put more air in the Baby Ruth candy bar.
That's exactly.
And by the way, Baby Ruth has reduced the number of peanuts and taken a lot of the caramel. But the point is, Phil used the example of the Doritos bag. This happens. Actually, the companies, by not changing the nominal price, are making it feel less bad to the consumer,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which helps Biden.
Which helps him, yes, exactly,
so,
right.
So, but he,
taking
of course,
some of the price shock away.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Taking
mm-hmm.
the price shock away. But he has the idea that if he attributes this to corporate greed, and inflation is caused by corporate greed, that he
that's
will
that's been his
deflect
narrative.
Deflect. It's not uncommon for progressives and
yep.
left liberals to argue this way. And the point that scientific economists make is, what? Corporations
right.
are suddenly now more greedy than they were before, and so they're somehow able to do this? No. It's because of the overall inflationary setting that this is going.
So what kind of solution is President Biden likely to propose to deal with shrinkflation?
Just
job
window dressing, basically.
No. He might impanel task forces and strike forces to say there have to be 20 Oreos in the Oreo bag and so forth.
And we'll be that, out there with a little tape measure to figure
yeah,
out and counting
no,
the number of chips that you get.
But well, this is... The Wall Street Journal is very worried about this,
yeah,
and I think rightly so, because this could be similar to the, you know, price controls, but not in
the,
not controlling the price. They're controlling the quantity offered at the price. And so,
yes,
it's a
de facto backdoor way to price controls.
It's a backdoor way, but it's even more hard to police.
Yeah.
And therefore more bureaucratically entangling and red tape laden and so forth.
And lest anyone think we joke, here in Oakland, major police enforcement that's been going on right now is not to crime. It's what are they doing? They're digging through dumpsters to figure out if you sorted your recyclables the right way.
Oh, man,
we'll
right.
take pictures of that. So, yes, never underestimate the ability of a bureaucrat to engage in the most tedious enforcement behavior imaginable. Right down to counting chips in a bag or number of Oreos in a package.
Right. Well, you know, the corporate greediness thing, people just aren't thinking it through carefully. I mean,
right.
Yes, there are people who are in business who are maybe motivated inordinately by greed, and maybe they're selfish. However, if you're going to impanel regulatory government experts, on what basis do you have a belief that those persons are going to be pure as the driven snow?
Oh, exactly.
Never subject to corruption and malfeasance or abuse. Aren't they all human beings? Aren't they all subject to, you know, wrongdoing?
Yeah. If anything, they're going to be worse because they're in the public sector. They're political actors. They're not
right.
engaged in market competition.
The companies are policed by their competitors.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
So if they're not making the customers happy, the custom will go to some rival company instead of to them.
Well, who polices the bureaucrats?
This is a question
they claim themselves, but it's always the private investigators. This notion that greedflation could even occur. I mean, imagine the amount of coordination that would take for every company in the economy decides that we're going to raise our price because we're greedy all at once. This is the level of absurdity of the argument behind this, and it's really been pushed by these fringe, they call themselves economists, but they're really kind of like Marxian crackpots, not even part of the profession in that sense, but they publish internet manifestos saying that greedflation and not monetary-based changes are the reason that we have inflation, and for whatever reason, they're overrepresented in the Biden White House's narrative right now.
Yeah, they certainly are. I mean, my main kind of closing thought on this point is that if you are a consumer and you're annoyed at the way that sometimes the elements in a package are shrunk a bit, we're not telling you you shouldn't be annoyed, but we're telling you don't let that fool you into thinking that the solution is going to be better if you get a bunch of regulators controlling it. It's going to be worse.
Right. You are getting at the potential bad incentives faced by government officials who might be doing this regulation and the susceptibility to going the wrong way. And
yeah,
as the ancient Romans asked, who will guard us from the guards?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. The people just don't think it through. They figure if something doesn't seem right, the government ought to do something about it. Well, actually, that's not always the right answer because it can be much worse. So let's talk about something else. We were conferring earlier about some of the issues, legal issues around Donald Trump in his property case. Bill, you had some comments about that, I think.
Well, the main thing I thought was, I mean, it's a kind of, all the cases against Trump are either shouldn't be brought at all, or they should be brought at a fine or misdemeanor or, small financial penalty kind of level. But anyway, this one is, he was getting loans and he was estimating the value of his property and he was describing his property. And so sometimes it was inaccurate, but the people that were lending him the money did their own independent evaluations and their own knockdowns of his claims. He paid back all the loans and they're not complaining and they still want to do business with him if his company ends up still existing. So the thing that's really interesting is we have a whole array of decisions on excessive fines. So the Constitution, essentially bars disproportionate fines. And it's clear from the line of cases that are cited by people that have written about this, that this is a wildly out of the ballpark fine that's being imposed on the Trump organization. So I think, this really hasn't even been commented on enough, but people have called the fine huge, astronomical, unprecedented, and so forth. So I think it's going to get thrown out.
You're not saying that Donald Trump gave an accurate evaluation of his holdings in his loan application.
He gave some inaccuracies, but
they were wildly inaccurate.
Not exactly the paragon of ethical representation.
he underestimated some of the values too.
Yes.
It was, the companies, the companies have a fiduciary responsibility to their stockholders to make an independent evaluation of whatever the backing is for the loans. And they're going to follow through on that, at least close enough for their purposes.
And the market's a sufficient correction if he does mislead. If he misleads his investors and they invest anyway, they go along with it, they're going to get penalized by the market.
That's right.
Yeah, so they could sue him, presumably, but I don't see how the state has a case against him. That's the trouble.
No, they don't. Exactly. They make their own evaluation. It's not, all right. I think we've stated this.
Yeah. Well, the point being that even if you think that Trump overinflated his valuations,
he did in some cases, and in some cases he underestimated.
But even where he did, the disproportionate penalties being imposed seem really to be disturbing.
Yeah, that's
if anything,
punitive.
There should
clearly
be some
punitive. Yeah.
Yes. If anything, there should be a minor fine, and it really shouldn't be any. It shouldn't even the case shouldn't have been brought.
We were talking about New York City-based properties primarily, I guess, with this. New York City is always...
No, but also it included Mar-a-Lago. And Mar-a-Lago
yeah, it did. That's true. Sure. That's true. But as to New York, I mean, New York City's always coming up with something, it seems like. And apparently, there's New York City has a lawsuit against the social media companies, whom we were describing earlier, for addicting children to their programs. Could this be, is it true that social media services are the functional equivalent of tobacco?
Well,
it's the new argument they want to make.
We're going to get into another old question about tobacco and freedom to consume things that are harmful. But the claim of New York City, this is Eric Adams, the mayor, is that they have a big load of mental health expenses. And mental health expenses pertaining to younger people. And that the reason why these people are mentally ill, question that we might have to examine, it's a big problem to establish that people are mentally ill because there's no physical sign of it usually. And to then attribute the cause and effect is even stranger. But they're saying that TikTok, Snapchat, Facebook, all these companies deliberately addicted, again, a very weaselly word because, you know, it's implying that there's no free choice of either the parents or the young people themselves in using this stuff.
Yeah.
And therefore, these companies owe a huge amount of maybe billions of dollars or something to New York City because they have caused mental illness in people who could not resist using their products. So it's Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Snapchat, TikTok that have been sued.
What I wonder when I hear this kind of thing is, I understand being annoyed with those companies, maybe even wanting to go on a moral crusade against them, but how is this a subject of litigation?
Because there's money on the table to be claimed.
That's right. There's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Uh-huh. I guess that's what it is.
That's basically what it is, and justifying predatory behavior by the government by linking it to a moral crisis. You know, I'd ask the question, why isn't the New York City public school system culpable for mental illness?
Right, exactly.
They never hold themselves accountable in that way.
Yeah, that is,
but it seems like the causal link is at least
a
strong.
That's a great suggestion. Phil, you and I should go in and be litigators. We could be litigators, front, raise some capital, find an ambulance-chasing lawyer, and put him on the job.
But it does seem that in so many of these kind of things, there is a propensity to turn issues like this of all sorts into legislative or judicialized gun tests, when really they should be the subject of maybe at most efforts to shame companies and whatnot, but to then bring them
also
legislative.
Parents.
Yeah, yeah. What
parents
about the
need to
right?
look at what their children are doing. I'm not saying it's easy. I had children during the rise of all these social media entities. And they also had the lure of video games, which could have easily be charged as somehow addicting or whatever. The point is, you have to get the kids.
The parents are buying the video games. It's the parents that are giving them the phones that have these things.
The parents are owning or renting the domiciles where the kids are doing a lot of this. So it's just they want to blame somebody else and they want a lot of money.
It's conveniently they go after the source where they think they can get the money.
Let's completely change the subject. Far afield, if we dare, So recently, Sweden has been admitted into membership in NATO, having right. overcome final objections, which wouldn't have happened, presumably, if Russia hadn't invaded Ukraine.
Right.
So there's kind of a series of dominoes here. But then recently, the chief of NATO says that Ukraine itself will inevitably end up joining NATO, which sounds to me like a recipe for infuriating the Russian leadership and exacerbating Ukraine's position on the battlefield and politically. I'm kind of puzzled by why the NATO chief would say that.
Well, I think, first of all, it's been promised a number of times. So that is a thing that falls on George W. Bush's administration.
Mm-hmm.
There's a kind of a rhetorical escalation that happens in wartime. And it's very hard to do what you actually need to do, which is step back and step away from war and step away from perpetual conflict. I think you're right, Graham. This is a recipe for
escalation,
serious tension and escalation.
Yeah.
It might work out to be a bargaining chip that, as part of
right.
ceasefire or disengagement negotiations, that Ukraine gives us up. And by the way, it's in their constitution that they're going to be part of NATO. And as I remember,
wow, yeah. the new constitution created at the end of
right,
the Cold War,
when
George W. Bush induced them to think that way. Yeah.
And, you know, but Zelensky has admitted that he doesn't really have to be in NATO. He'd like some external allies. It doesn't have to be NATO. And I think he's more interested in being part of the European Union. There's a fascinating problem with, so what does Ukraine make? Well, one thing it makes is grain, okay? Lots and lots of grain. Well, Polish farmers also make grain. So do they want grain? No, they'd just soon see the Ukrainian economy go down the toilet rather than let the grain from this poor, war-stricken country come in. No, they have part of this farmer rebellion in Europe is actually against, I mean, some of it's quite valid, anti-zero emissions,
anti-bureaucracy,
red tape, all sorts of stuff like that. But part of it is protectionism, and part of that protectionism is against Ukrainian grain. So,
new topic. We have heard a lot about AI. I think it's supposed to be the savior of the world, or else the end of the world. It seems to be always one or the other. I'm kind of perplexed about it, but I'm especially worried when I hear these reports that all these AI systems are programmed somehow to learn progressive ideological values and replicate them in all their answers. Do you know what this is about?
Yeah. So we saw the recent display of this. This was the Google Gemini program, and they had some very embarrassing news stories about them just over the last couple of weeks as they launched this AI image generator, and you could type in terms into it.
Oh, yeah, I saw those.
And it turns out that the images were pre-programmed to favor and prioritize, for lack of a better word, diversity, DEI images. So you could put a request in, show a picture of Nazi soldiers, and it generated a picture of Nazi soldiers, and one of them's black, one of them's female. All the diversity categories are checked off. So it's completely counter-historical.
I was going to say, is that how the Nazi armies were staffed?
That's exactly what... and it's just a succession of these absurdities, historical falsehoods, based on the fact that it was pre-programmed to prioritize diversity pictures. So it had incorporated the ideology. And then the same thing is going on with the chat-based versions of it, where you enter in like a question. It'll spit out an answer.
If you ask them about F.A. Hayek, don't expect an objective answer.
Exactly. Or if you ask them about Anthony Fauci, and I tried this after reading about it on the internet, if you ask them to say anything negative about Anthony Fauci, it spits out, Anthony Fauci is a hero of epidemiology who saved us during COVID, is basically the line that it'll give you. So it's a really disparate asymmetry that you get between figures that are on the left and everyone else and the way that this thing is treating it.
I think we're going to end up with competing universes of AI, chat, and images, because it's, again, first of all, even the people that create this AI don't exactly know how it works. And so I think we're going to end up, you know, certainly, I mean, imagine you're in Saudi Arabia and, you know, are you really going to want this Google image in your country? I mean, I can think of many, there's got to be competing companies. And if they want to have some kind of dominant position, they have to have much greater neutrality. And they're really just going to kind of tone down and cover up this. I don't think they're going to really purge this political inclination out of it. Phil, do you think?
I don't either. So I liken it. It's like a really sophisticated, high-tech version of a Mechanical Turk. This machine that actually has a human programmer behind it and has the biases and values of that human programmer behind it. And no matter what you do, you cannot get the machine to truly think for itself, truly think independently. It's always going to represent what it was trained on. So that raises like a philosophical question. Is this truly artificial intelligence? I think it has elements, but it's clearly not something that's thinking of these things on its own. It's taking the cues from the way it was programmed.
I don't think it is somehow artificial intelligence, emphasize on the intelligence.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that I'm pretty sure there can't be artificial intelligence.
I tend to inquire that way as well.
Yeah, you know, there's enhanced aspects of human stuff, and we have to carefully welcome all that. And that's
impression is that the way it works, and this is to totally an amateur thinking here, but these AI systems vacuum up massive amounts of data.
Right.
And they configure it through programming prioritizations that they receive from the programmers, but massive amounts of information, and then kind of replicate it, find patterns, put it back together again in different ways. But what seems to me be going on here is that the AI systems are absorbing the attitudes and social values of a particular slice of society, which is to say the progressive mindset and attitudes of people who work in Silicon Valley and San Francisco and so forth. And AI thus is just an image of that social class's preoccupations, even though it's based upon, you know, masses of data that they vacuum up.
Okay, so let's think of some possible great uses, though.
Okay.
So let's say you were trying to make a syllabus for a course at George Mason University in economic history. Okay. So, and you didn't feel like doing every little bit of it. You'd like to have some mechanical assistance for things that each day would be more or less the same. You'd always have a homework assignment. It could help you do some of that. You have to be careful because, of course, it can create things like false articles that don't actually exist or facts.
You have to proofread it.
And you have to know the topic already so that you can spot the erroneous thing. Or let's say you were the head of a think tank and you needed to raise money. You could ask the artificial intelligence to look at your past donor records and say, who am I missing that could be giving money? Now, you already do this, but
we have
humans doing it, and you yourself might do it. But the artificial intelligence might pick up a few people that you have forgotten or hadn't jumped out at you. Again, you have to totally check. Maybe they're dead. Maybe they're not going to give money. They said, this is our last dime. But the thing is, it can do mechanical stuff like that that can be used.
Efficiently at that.
Yeah, and think of, you could reduce production costs for classroom stuff. I mean, I have this horrible nightmare in my own imagination, so the professors, you know, they generate all the classroom content. And then, of course, the lectures, those could be generated too. Yeah. So then,
they now have the AI that will read the text that it generates for you.
That's right.
And it will
have a vision of you, a visual of you that looks like you.
Right. And then the students come in with their AI receptors. They plug it in. And so the two AI systems talk to each other.
Or just talking to each other.
Think of the reduction in production costs.
Here's the thing. I still think there's going to be some human beings doing some stuff. Because people said, when we have radio, or when we have movies,
or
when we have
press.
Television. We have the printing press.
There won't be any writing out by hand.
There won't really be need for human beings anymore in passing along knowledge or gaining knowledge or learning, whatever. It hasn't really shown to be true. It's essentially shown that for particular purposes, this can enhance productivity. But I think we can be confident human beings still have a role, but I think it's funny to see the prejudices of the left liberal elite so humorously exposed
in an undeniable way.
It really is funny.
It's a little world turned in on itself ideologically.
But I don't think we can count on them to somehow change over to a neutral thing. It's going to have to be competition.
Competition. And part of that's the embarrassment that they've
had. That's right. Shame can also figure here.
Can we talk about something totally different from this, maybe in closing here? This is a hard subject, and I mentioned it at the beginning. Let's talk about the Alabama Supreme Court ruling in February of 2024. I'm not sure how best to sort out the issues here myself. Let me just summarize a couple of the facts for us. So there were a group of families in Alabama undergoing in vitro fertilization processes. They had some frozen embryos that were pending the next part of the procedure. The company that had them dropped them on the floor and destroyed some of their embryos. The family sued.
No, it was a visitor that went into an open door.
But the company was responsible for it.
So they weren't keeping them secure.
Yeah, they weren't keeping them secure. Right. So they got sued by these families. And then the Alabama Supreme Court ultimately decided mid-February of 2024 that, in fact, the company was liable, and that what they were liable for was that these were human beings being destroyed, and that they had status and rights under the law, even though they were not implanted in utero and were not yet growing and had not been born, obviously. It had pronounced very definitively, the court in Alabama said, that on the basis of both statutory and constitutional, Alabama constitutional law, that these unborn embryos had rights as persons under Alabama law, which then, of course, set up howls of concern all over the political spectrum. Republicans were just as concerned as Democrats because lots of families rely upon in vitro fertilization. The families don't always really think through carefully the implications of what's happening, but they're relying on it. And so the Alabama legislature went to work and in about 2.5 weeks' time came up with legislation to rectify the problem because all the IVF clinics had shut down their operations in view of the court decision. The Alabama legislature came up with a piece of legislation signed by Governor Kay Ivey, which waived and gave liability from civil and criminal prosecution to in vitro fertilization doctors so that they wouldn't be at risk of criminal prosecution as they proceeded. So this seemed like at least a short-term solution to what was considered to be a very difficult problem. I have some thoughts about this, but I thought I would ask you guys, what do you think? I mean, as people, both of you value individual liberty, what are your thoughts about this complicated issue?
Well, I think, first of all, I don't think the legislative solution can work long-term because this is embedded in their state constitution that life begins at conception. It's a problem because it's treating this fertility clinic as if it's a daycare center. And as if they negligently let a murderer in that murdered these children. And to me, it's a problem because it's a problem about fetal personhood. So the question that arises is essentially as soon as, so these embryos were, they had been fertilized about a few days, okay, less than a week, and then they were frozen to be later implanted, or so at least some of them were going to be implanted. So I don't think they're real persons, okay? It's they're too undeveloped.
So you have to be more developed to count as a human
yes,
being?
Yes. And if you look at philosophers who've tried to think about this and theologians, they often, there are people of immense intelligence on both sides of this issue, but St. Augustine argued that, you know, you shouldn't treat abortion as murder. Aquinas had a theory about how developed the fetus had to be. The Catholic Church wouldn't give baptism of aborted or miscarried babies until the 19th century. So they didn't really view, not that they're dispositive, but they, of course, been thinking about this thousands of years.
St. Augustine didn't have genetics and ultrasonography. So it's, okay. It's a different, different technology.
Okay.
He lacked information.
I'm buying that, but he did also have some insight. So clearly, genetically, you know, this embryo is the beginnings of a
It has its own distinct
person.
Genetic identity that doesn't match any cell in the mother's body.
Agreed.
And if you wait some time, it's going to change further. And it's not clear to me that there's any point where you can empirically distinguish its nature from what it was on the first moment of its existence. You can make philosophical and religious arguments, but empirically, there's no bright line where it changes from non-human person to human person.
But this is why we have philosophy and theology, to try to help us handle difficult factual and physical things. So the Jewish view historically has been, well, the baby has to be born. There's views about brain development. So Aquinas said, well, it's not really in the form and fleshed out thing, and so there it hasn't, the soul has not already entered into it. Again, you can dispute this, but the idea, and this is in the American public's opinion polls, it's the same sort of thing. In the first trimester, the public will tell you, again, it's not dispositive, we don't have to go along with it. But part of the reason all these politicians are rushing to say, okay, we don't want to end in vitro fertilization, is that the public thinks that the first trimester is not a true person yet. And it's hard for me to say that these embryos should be on our healthcare plans, should be counted in the census, should be maybe in some cities put on school boards or water boards because they're a full person. I don't buy it.
There were pictures in CNN of protesters on the Alabama Supreme Court grounds. One of the protesters had a big sign saying, you can't cuddle an embryo.
That might be going too far, too. You know,
I've known a lot of pregnant women, and they felt they were cuddling the embryo before birth.
They're holding it in them. That's pretty close.
Yeah.
I think we have to admit that this is a very difficult problem. I mean, there's other aspects of this.
It's difficult to legislate around.
It's very difficult to legislate around.
Yeah. But in my view, they made a mistake of putting in the Constitution this position. It makes it much harder to try and deal with it. Now,
there's probably an issue of intent there. I very much doubt that anyone that wrote that provision of the Constitution was thinking about a case of an accident occurring at an in vitro fertilization clinic. And yet, here they have the law.
Things, We know, if you read the news articles around this, we know this is not the first time something like this has happened,
right.
Or the first time there's been a lawsuit. The thing is also, though, people test these embryos to try and see if something, some terrible debilitating disease is going to be present in the developed baby before they implant it. And they also throw away some of these. And
yeah,
this
they cull the weak ones and kill them.
Yes, that's right. So the question is, as I said, are these things like daycare centers?
Well,
is that what these clinics are? Are they daycare centers?
Your point is well taken. Let me toss an idea from a completely left field position here, just to get a little bit of thought going. I wonder, reflecting on these things, legally speaking, certainly the U.S. Supreme Court in the Dobbs decision threw it back to the states.
Right.
The states are handling it in different ways. Alabama, I wonder if Alabama may have inadvertently stumbled upon a resolution of these life-related issues that might actually have a little stability and sense to it. And here's what I mean. Given the passage of the legislation after the ruling of the Alabama Supreme Court, the status quo in Alabama is that the court has declared on the basis of the Alabama Constitution that these are human lives from the moment of conception.
The legislature
has decided that violations of those human lives in this context cannot be prosecuted.
So they're saying we're passing a law that the law should not be faithfully executed. I don't think that's a stable solution.
Well, they're carving out an area of the law that is circumstance specific.
Yeah, and the law is only addressing prosecution. It's giving liability or protection against liability without opposing the court's decision. So what I'm getting at, is it possible that the law can condemn something without penalizing it?
It's part of legal history. We have different categories of murder. We have different categories
Exactly.
Every crime imaginable.
That's right.
And they're very circumstance specific. So maybe that is the...
Based on knowledge and intent and so forth.
Exactly.
The question of humanness is not varying per type of murder, but the question of prosecutability and culpability does vary. So what I'm thinking here is that it may be that Alabama has found a way to go back to a more ancient form of law, where law is recognized as having an educative function that is not always coercive in its effects. So I know that libertarians say often that they oppose state action because it's coercive, and they're usually right about that, I would say. But what can they say when state action is not coercive? Like in this case, what's happening here is that it's non-action. So is non-action coercive action? It seems like what's happening is the state of Alabama is affirming the personhood and humanity of these unborn people, but limiting the prosecution of those who violate them. Now, whether that's consistent morally is a different matter, but legally, it may be that you're able to affirm the humanness of these embryos, but also in recognition of limitations of knowledge and experience and motivation and intent.
It's a different entity. Yeah.
Can you have a law that doesn't punish? I think the answer is yes.
Okay, so now I'm a leading pro-life activist, and I figure out some grounds where I'm being injured, and I go and I say, this statute is unconstitutional.
They could say that. I actually went and looked at the Alabama Constitution because I was curious on this point. Here's what it literally says in the relevant piece. It says that the Constitution, quote, acknowledge, declare, affirm, that it's the public policy of the state to ensure the protection of the rights of the unborn child in all manners and measures lawful and appropriate.
So that last little phrase is
that's giving the legislature a space for this kind of implementing legislation that limits liability and forestalls and prevents punishment. It's a fascinating combination.
So it's an acting cause is basically
that's what I'm saying.
A deference to some legislative judgment there.
Right. They deliberately put the appropriate.
It's really interesting.
Isn't that fascinating? So what if Alabama has found a way to get away from the hardest edges of our dilemma on this thing by finding a way to let the law affirm the humanness of the unborn child, but also to limit the prosecution and punishment of those who violate it, especially early on in the earliest moments, which is in vitro fertilization. That's a thought. That's a thought. Bill's not satisfied, I know. Bill, you want to say that
I made my points. I think you make an interesting point. I just think it's better to have a legal system that's architectonically consistent.
And some people would say that you can't really have a law that doesn't punish people for violating it. And that's a very narrow view of law, but it is one classic view of law. The law to be law must be coercive.
Certainly realists and positivist theorists might say that, but natural law people might go along with your educative.
Yes, educative. There you go.
I think we've potentially exhausted this topic.
I think we have, but thank you for bearing with me. Thank you for bearing with me and bringing out an idea from kind of a totally different angle. And thank you for addressing all the other difficult issues of the day, Phil Magnus and Williamson Evers. Let me give you each a chance to make your last comment on what you think important that you want to say about public life this week or month.
Well, I'll go completely in a different direction. Pay attention that the president seems like he's going to plow full steam ahead in advocating a wealth tax. And including a wealth tax on unrealized capital gains. I think in economic news, this is going to be a significant discussion.
Wow.
But it also shows a very wrong-headed way of thinking about income, thinking about economic activity when you start penalizing the private sector for wealth generation that really hasn't been executed or realized yet.
Wow, that's a huge threat to American prosperity.
So my field is education policy, even though I've ranged all over the universe of policy in this discussion. And one fascinating thing is in Los Angeles, a leading candidate for school board, endorsed by the teachers union, endorsed by the Confederation of Labor in Los Angeles County, turned out to be a vocal anti-Semite. And they terrible time dealing with. So he was a left-wing progressive from racially oppressed minority, long time working with the unions. And here he was, he turned out to be virulently anti-Jewish. And it was revealing, and it was also comical in a horrifying way.
Yeah, good grief. Okay, thank you for bringing that to our attention, both of you. Thank you for our friends and viewers who join us for these conversations. We hope that you will turn to our website, independent.org, for all sorts of interesting background and in-depth analysis of lots of issues in the news, and always standing ready to try and fulfill our own educative function as a research organization. Thanks for what you do toward that end, Phil Magnus, Williamson Evers. Thanks to all our friends. Join us again on Independent Outlook. Take care, everyone.